Welcome back to the Positivity Podcast for Season 2 with me, your host, Robert Coach Campbell. If this is your first time joining us, then I hope you're ready for amazing guests with the best positivity life stories. My guest this episode is without doubt one of the most talented comedians in the UK today. His stand-up show, Quip Off The Mark, is selling out everywhere it goes. He can also be found appearing on TV shows like Mock The Week, as well as hosting his own hugely successful podcast, Jokes With Mark. So, without further ado, let's get into episode 8 with the very, very funny and talented Mark Simmons. Who is Mark Simmons?
Mark Simmons is a one-liner stand-up comedian. How much more do you want?
Yeah,
I mean, there's a lot to get into.
Yeah, well, it's always one I ask, because I always like to see how people define themselves, you know, as opposed to, especially with people like yourself who are in the media, how the media define you, because a lot of comics are defined, and it's not who they really are, and, you know, people miss, actually, the intelligence in the comedy sometimes, and brand them as something they're not,
In comedy, I think people, I mean, especially TV people, I think they want a very obvious persona that they can market, essentially. Do you know what I mean? It's like, so people can go, I think maybe it's not even just the industry, it's like people in general, it's like people want to be able to say, oh, that one. Like Jack D, oh, the miserable one. That's a very simple way to define
I totally agree, because it's something I find within my mental health support work and my coaching work, that we are so keen to have people in a box. There's no, you know, everybody has to be a certain demographic, a certain sex, a certain race, a certain type of person, like you say with Jack D, the miserable one, you know, the happy one, whatever it is. And it seems
for
to
me,
be,
I'm one-liner comedian. That's what I'm sort of, that's my thing, because I haven't really got another thing that's, because I do one-liners, I don't talk about issues or politics or anything like that. So that is the only really way to describe it within the industry, I think. the hobbies guy I get now because of the online videos and things.
Yeah. Which seem to be absolutely everywhere at the moment, because it's like, everybody I talk to, it's like, have you seen this video? And it's like, I think you probably do yourself a disservice describing yourself as a one-liner guy, because I think the intelligence it takes to use that sort of linguistic prowess is different level. I think it's I think anybody who sees it and really gets, you know, I've got a big background in neurolinguistics, so I know how much it takes to think that quickly to a one-line response. I suppose the only other person I've seen similar is Milton Jones. But he obviously has a wacky haircut and a bright coloured shirt. So that puts him into that box.
There you go. That's it. That's how you know him. You know the guy from Mock the Week? Who's that? The guy with the weird hair. Oh, that guy.
He's crazy. Stupid. So what was young Mark like? You know, how did you grow up?
Where did I grow up, did you say?
Where, how, you know, what got you to where you are now, I suppose?
So, I grew up in Kent, in a village called Sellinge, which is like between Ashford, Canterbury, Folkestone. I was quite shy, unless I was within some, unless I was comfortable, basically. So if I had a family, I'd be messing around. Like when I was a little kid, my sort of grandparents and parents would say, oh, he's going to be a comedian. Do you know what I mean? It's that sort of thing. Yeah. But that never progressed, because I think when I was at school, I was sort of ginger hair, quite sort of freakishly tall for like for the age of and so I was always a bit, I think, quite self-conscious in those environments, so I don't think I really, my personality really came out unless I was in like a group of friends who I'm comfortable with, I think. So going into comedy is very, people wouldn't have expected it, I don't think. People that knew me as a kid, Yeah, I mean, I don't know how much detail. So, because then, so that progression then went to when after. So, when I'd go to university and like, and even when I was at school, any sort of presentation in front of people, I wouldn't feel comfortable at all. Like, I'd really try to avoid it as much as possible. I just didn't like just people, just no expression looking at me when I'm talking. Like, I think it was that I don't like the idea that they weren't very interested, like they were bored or
It's
anything
hard
like
to gauge a
that.
room when you've got no sort of comeback. Suppose where
Yeah, and
university
also,
is like that. You're kind of presenting something that's not got a punchline where you get an instant response.
it's like I'd be talking about things I didn't know enough about really, or I wasn't passionate about. So, whereas I also taught taekwondo from quite a young age because my dad teaches it. So, but in front of a class since I was 15, doing taekwondo, teaching taekwondo, I was always fine standing up in front of people, and that's not getting laughs. That's just I know what I'm talking about, so I feel confident. I think that's
You've got
was
that
always the
passion.
issue.
You've got that passion
Yeah,
for it.
because I did sports science at university. And I liked it, but I didn't care about it really. It wasn't something I was really passionate about. So when I did a presentation, it's not like I threw myself into the. Maybe that's what I should have done. Maybe I should have just really known the topic inside out. But yeah, so I was never. So I never thought I could do stand up really. I'd never considered it. It's just I always liked stand up, but I didn't. It didn't even enter my mind that I could try it. I didn't know there were comedy clubs. I knew nothing about the industry. I just had seen Jimmy Carr, Lee Evans on TV or DVD. But actually, like the first comedy gig I did, that was the first comedy club I'd ever been to. As in the first time I did a gig, I'd never been as a punter because my mate had. I basically when I left uni, I started working in the gym for a short amount of time, and just randomly, a friend of a friend was training in there. And I was chatting to him, and he'd been doing the London open mic circuit, so he's telling me all about it. And I've always liked the idea of doing sketches and things like that. And he just convinced me to go and have a go one day. So when I went, it was like this crazy experience of this sort of underground world I didn't know existed. It was like such a buzz. And I went on and I was so nervous, and apparently I didn't look up once. I was looking at the ground the whole time. But I got a laugh, and that really gave me this feeling that I'd never experienced before. And I was like, oh my goodness, I'm in. I am in. And I haven't looked back since.
And that was it. You've just gone from there.
I sort of learned the hard way. Looking at it now, because I see people that do comedy courses, and I know people that run comedy courses, I'm like, why didn't I do a comedy course? Like, it would have saved probably a few years in sort of learning things, but I just went in old school, learnt through failure, essentially. I didn't know, before I started, I didn't know how to write jokes, I didn't know anything. So, whereas if you go on a course, they'll teach you structure and what this is and what that is, but no, I just sort of. So, it took me a little while to sort of work my way up the ladder. But I do quite like that it's taken a while because that's how the old school lot did it.
And I suppose it's kind of learning your trade, isn't it? It's through experience rather than just education. It's something I focus on with what I do was I had the experience myself on the mental health side. I suffered with PTSD when I left the military, and it was I knew I wanted to go into sort of mental health support, life development coaching, that sort of thing, but I didn't know how to apply it, and that's where COVID I benefited from because it gave me 2 years to just absolutely study psychology and neurolinguistics
Amazing.
and put that, the sort of technical and the practical together, I suppose. So I think it probably makes me, and without trying to be arrogant, better than some of the other people who are out there who've just learned it on a course or a book. I've also lived it, and I suppose that's similar to what you're saying with the comedy clubs. It's earning your spurs, as they used to say.
It's interesting you say about COVID helping because COVID changed my career. essentially, because I learned to edit. I just when I was in COVID, I just thought I need to do something, gain some sort of knowledge or advantage or something. I don't know what spurred me to do it, but I learned to edit videos, and I'd got a few videos, I'd like f shows I'd filmed, because I didn't really ever used to film many shows, but I had some. And what I did, I just clipped them all up into short clips and put them on TikTok, and it blew up, just went crazy. And then, because back then no one else was really doing it, whereas now, like
Everybody's doing
everyone
it.
and their mother's putting up stand-up clips. And but the trouble is, then I ran out of footage because we're still in lockdown and we weren't gigging. And then I just bought a camera. And as soon as we opened up again, I filmed every single gig since. And I make it's like a ritual now, because like I've had a few where like I'll be like, oh, the camera, it's a bit awkward setting up the camera in the audience and all that. And it was those gigs that I wouldn't do it. They thought something always really good happened in the
And
gig,
you missed
that
it.
always the way. So now it's just a rule. I film absolutely everything. So I've just got so many gigs, like footage of my gigs, but it's really, really useful.
I think it was a big thing with COVID for me. I and the whole business setup for Coach Campbell is choose positivity, and it's it's making positive choices, finding positivity where there's a negative. And I think for a lot of people during the negative of COVID, a lot of people were applying that philosophy and finding a positive. It's we kind of seen it as a country as well. Everybody got behind the NHS and everybody kind of came together for a bit. And as soon as COVID was gone, that's it. We've all separated and scuttled off back to our boxes. If we're Conservative, Labour, support the NHS, don't support the NHS. It's one of the things I always say is quite sad, because it was a great opportunity to kind of unite a whole country and do a lot of good, and we did. But as soon as COVID kind of didn't become a talking point anymore, we've kind of
That's
fractured
normal.
again, and back to what we had 2 years ago. It seems like a wasted opportunity, I suppose.
I know, 'cause you almost forget that it even happened.
It's frightening. It's frightening.
So funny that you say my brain works. It's like as soon as you said choose positivity, all I wanted to do was say that sounds shit. That's just like, and I held it back and I thought, no, I'll tell you that.
It's good to hear, because it's one of those things where I like to hear everybody's opinion, and that's why I've got
No,
such a
no, no, no,
diverse.
no. No, just as a joke.
No, but it is. It's some
Like,
people.
I think it sounds great.
Some people genuinely do, and I've had it where I went into a business and I was coaching, and I had a group of maybe 20 guys, and there was just one guy there the whole time, and everything I said, he was just like, "Ah, bollocks." And I was like, okay, I've got my one. We're probably like yourself. You get the heckler who just has
Your
paid to come and
nemesis.
see you just to be annoyed by you, and it's but it's one of those things that I suppose my time in the military, I look back on and I think, well, why did I do it? And it's so we could have freedom of opinion and that sort of thing, freedom of speech. So it's one of those things. But I always find people eventually do get to a point where they go, I need something else. I need that bit of help. Because, I always educate on mental health. Everybody has mental health. The way we brand it, we were talking about branding earlier, branding comedians. It's mental health is branded wrongly, because we talk about it as mental illness. It's mental illness we talk about when we talk about mental health. So it's like, there's something wrong with him.
Oh,
He's got bad
yes, I
mental health.
see.
And it's mental health can be a positive. Somebody who can deal with things, somebody who can help people, somebody who can educate. It's same as I liken it to physical health. So your mental health's the same as your physical health. You'll have illness and you also have good health. So it's getting the branding right. We're too quick to go to a negative brand with it. But yeah, you
It's
always.
very popular in comedy at the moment. The actual brand of mental health, it's used a lot, I think.
There's that. I think probably when you're in the industry like I am, there's a frustration where people use it just as a buzzword, or people use it as a get out of jail, in a business sense, where I've done something wrong, I'm gonna say it's mental health or whatever, and they use it. It's such a shame, but we
You
that's
no one can question it, so people are
it
using
seems
it.
to be that thing. Whereas I'm terrible for it, and I've always been that kind of person where I will challenge it, you know, because it's not just the challenge of I think you're using it incorrectly or you're doing it the wrong way. It's also the challenge of maybe I can help you, you know, and sometimes it leads to people's embarrassment because they're kind of like, oh, right, this guy knows what he's talking about and he's trying to help me, and actually I've just been a bit fictitious to get out, you know, being late for work for the 14th time this year,
but
it's the way it goes. So obviously I talked about neurolinguistics for me, and for yourself, you've obviously got such a great grasp of the English language and the application, you know, and the one-liner. Where does that come from? Because is it a natural talent or is it something you've learned?
Well, I don't know. I don't really know if I have got a great... I don't know, really. I don't know. I've always been sort of quite quick.
Yeah.
I think when I was a kid, I was actually thinking about this yesterday because I got asked a similar question in an interview and hadn't really thought about it before. But I think when I was a kid, what I tended to get told off for a lot was like a smart ass response, like talking back, which essentially is you think of a like something quick and then you say it, and then adults don't like that. Do you know what I mean? Because you're a kid.
Yeah.
So I think I've always had that sort of mind, and my dad and my older brother were quite quick. So I was always, and my brother's older, sort of 4 years older. So I was always kind of competing with that. And he's very intelligent as well. So educational wise, like he was very good at school. He's a teacher now. I was competing. And then, I don't know, I think when I was watching comedy, I was always drawn to one-liners. I remember the first time I watched Jimmy Carr. It was before he was famous. It was his first Royal Variety performance, and I remember watching it and just being. It's the first time I'd seen one-liners where you really had to think to get it.
Yeah.
And the satisfaction that gave you, and I don't know why that made it was a big, more quite an impact on me, because I remember exactly where I was sitting, who was sitting where. I really remember that when I saw that, and maybe that was because my brain worked like that. Maybe it was that's what really resonated with me.
Yeah, that recognition of something you liked. Yeah, I think it's missed in comedy a lot. The actual levels of intelligence and the layers, and especially, you know, like Milton Jones, as I've said before, he portrays the goofy, you know, hair, bright shirt, all that. And it's almost like it's a distraction that he uses to then lull you into how clever the one-liner is then built to be. Yeah, and I love comedy. It's just one of those things. But I love the intelligence of it. I think probably more than some of the comedy. There's comedians I've liked over the years that Frankie Boyle's probably won at the start, I think, because that genre was very much short comedy, whereas now I look at and I just find it boring and repetitive. I don't make apologies for that. You know,
that was trendy at the time, wasn't it? And no one had really seen it, I don't think, like that. So it's all new. But the more you see something, you know,
it's kind of one trick pony. It's you know, sometimes I suppose maybe it is the change in genres and the change in time. You kind of look at it and you think, well, it's outdated, and now it's almost to a level offensive, in ways. Whereas other comedians from that era, like Jimmy Carr and stuff, and they work quite closely writing material, which is, I find bizarre. Is obviously he keeps that shocking element, but there's more layers in what he does and the intelligence behind the comedy.
Yeah, yeah. When comedians start, they quite often go for shock comedy first, because when you don't know what you're doing, you just want a reaction from the audience. Yeah. So you do notice that a lot of new comics will try and say something to get the audience to go like that, and then they gradually grow as a performer and cut that sort of stuff out. But that's quite common, actually.
And did you ever go that direction?
I don't think so.
Do you think you just got that? You just clicked.
The thing is, it's some of my. I do write jokes that are more sort of shocking. I don't know, triggering.
Yeah.
But the way it's a difficult thing, the whole offensive joke thing, because I think some comedians sit down and they go, right, I'm going to write a joke about transgender people. Let's do it.
Yeah.
Whereas when I write jokes, I go, the wordplay is always the first thing.
Yeah.
And then you then have to work backwards from the wordplay
to create the joke,
to create the thing. And sometimes the only way to make that joke technically work is to use a trigger word, maybe, that make people a bit uncomfortable.
Yeah.
But majority of the jokes aren't offensive at all, but audiences can hear a word, they tense up.
Yeah,
and then they won't laugh because they're either worried or they have to analyze it too much before they can accept that it's okay.
Yeah.
And some audiences just get triggered super easy for no reason.
Yeah.
So so I tend not to really do that stuff.
Yeah.
Unless I kind of preempt it by telling the audience,
yes,
that's what they do. And just to trust me as a performer that I'm not going do anything. Like, I've had quite a few things where, so even I had a joke, you know, the Nigerian prince emails.
Yes.
So I've got a joke where I'd say, let me think how I start it. I recently transferred quite a lot of money to a Nigerian prince. So in that setup, you instantly think the emails, right?
Yeah.
That's it's known as a thing.
Yeah.
But some audiences hear Nigerian.
Yes.
And they worry where you're going with
it.
So then, I mean, this is ruining the joke because I'm breaking it down too much. But the wordplay, so Nigerian prince, I then say brilliant tribute act.
Yes.
So the wordplay is, it's a Nigerian
prince
tribute act.
Yeah.
Nothing offensive about that in the slightest. That's quite a feasible thing, that a Nigerian man can be a tribute act of Prince.
Yeah.
Zero offence there. That's not a thing.
Yeah.
But the audiences will hear it. And then I had one where it was a really kind of hipstery crowd.
Yeah.
And it just went deathly silent. And I was like, what's happened there?
Yeah.
And this one guy just went, shook his head. And I was like, why? Because I won't leave it. Because if you leave it, to everyone in there, you've done something wrong.
Yeah. And then it becomes a thing on social media.
It can do.
Yeah.
So I said to the guy that shook his head, I said, why are you shaking your head? He went, move on. Like that, and I went no, and then I basically went through the joke. I mean, I lost all the funny out of this, but I went through the, but they didn't like it anyway. But I went through the joke, and I just broke it all down. I went, can you tell me what's wrong with that?
Yeah,
and they couldn't. They couldn't, because there isn't anything. So it's a really strange thing, because I've done, up to that point, I've done lots of jokes. They all like them, really nice jokes. Nothing offensive in the slightest. Yeah. Nothing to even make them worried that I might be. Someone that's, you know, that would do that. And then I was like, please just trust me. Like, it's like, if there is something bad, talk to me afterwards. And I'd happily take, if there was something wrong with that, I'd happily take, someone's advice. But there isn't. But people just get panicky. So I tend, that's a long way of telling you, I tend not to sort of go down that route.
Because
my sole purpose is to make everybody laugh. That's what I want to do.
Yeah.
So if there's a chance that one of the jokes isn't going to be consistent, I won't do it. But it's just frustrating for me because the technical wordplay is quite nice.
Yeah, there's nothing offensive in it. And I suppose that's where my interest in neurolinguistics sort of comes in, because we're programmed by the media in a neurolinguistic way that there's trigger words that as soon as we hear transgender, race, you know, Nigerian... Mm. Straight away, it's, oh, something bad's coming. And it's, why is something bad coming? You know, it's really weird.
It's just history, I suppose, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's just the history of...
And a lot of it's like created offence. Like you say, not stereotyping the hipster crowd, but there's groups within, you know, the country, the world, wherever we are pre-programmed to take offence on other groups' behalfs. And I always find that weird. I had the experience, I was in a bar. There was a conversation about race, and somebody said to me, "Oh, well, you've got quite a racist opinion." And I said, "Well, the opinion, whatever the discussion was, is based on fact." And he went, no, I'm not having it, and stormed off. And that night, I was out with, it was a military group, so there was three Nigerians, two Trinidadians, and the rest were made up by Fijians. I was the only sort of white, face in the group. And I was like, but it was a conversation we were having, and it was like, how can you take offence for multiple groups of ethnicity when you're coming from a place where you don't even know me, you've never met me? And I suppose that's the thing with comedy. You're meeting people for the first time, you've never met them before, and you're getting up and saying something, and they're judging you off one word or their preconception of where that word is going to lead. That's where I'm big on breaking neuro-linguistic programming.
yeah. It'd be interesting to see. Now I'm touring my own show to people that are specifically coming to see me now.
Yes.
It would be interesting if I did those bits to see their reaction once some coming as from people
because
that trust.
Because people know you and trust you.
Yeah.
You've built that level. Yeah.
I don't know. It's an interesting one.
Yeah. It must be one of those things that, if I had the skill set or the courage, I'd love to be able to do comedy just for the experience. I love experiences. So that experience of standing up and being completely vulnerable to a group of people you've never met. It's like you say, starting off quite shy and retiring and never getting there, just to doing what you do now is like the most ultimate transition, I suppose you could.
You know what? I think it was almost like, so I used to sort of get embarrassed quite easily. Like, I'm redhead, so I'd sort of go a bit red in the face. And when I was at school, I'd get a bit of stick for that. So I think that sort of, I guess that lost me confidence in standing in front of people. But I think doing comedy is, subconsciously, I think it's almost been a bit of an FU, like motivation.
Yeah.
Like, because that is literally the worst job I could possibly do for that affliction of being worried about talking in front of people. And I do get motivated in general by negativity towards something, I think. Like when I was, like if I was doing sport, I used to do a lot of sport, and if someone said I wouldn't be able to do something, I'd use that to motivate me. So I liked having something to drive me like that. So that may be why I've sort of persisted with it. I don't know.
Yeah. What a good job you've done it, because you've made a career out of it.
And it's the best job in the world. Like I love it so much. That's what I'd advise to anyone, any young person, find the thing that genuinely interests you.
Yeah.
And do that, because you can't be wanting to go to work.
Yeah.
I think it's
something I struggled with when I left the military. Was while I was in the military for that 20-odd year period, I knew what I was doing. I had a purpose. I enjoyed what I was doing. And then obviously one day you leave and you're taken out of that group. The security blanket's taken away, and it's like, all right, I'm 15 years old again. What do I want to do? Do business, do this, pubs, restaurants, corporate gigs, all that sort of thing. And then it was just COVID came along, and I had to deal with my PTSD as well eventually. And it was like, okay, well, I've had that experience. Okay, what can I now do? And as soon as I started putting together what Coach Campbell would look like as a sort of charitable business and a business assistance tool for companies to help with the mental health in the workplace and things like that. It was like, I love what I do, and then the podcast obviously came off the back of that, where people were like, well, not everybody gets to meet you and sit and talk to you, what about doing like a podcast? And I never even thought about a podcast, but I put a couple of episodes out, and it went down a storm, and I get a lot of feedback from people saying, oh, I heard so-and-so's story, and I remember being say, like yourself, like that awkward kid, and the advice to just challenge myself and attack, you know, the negative. And
you know, I wish I could have, I know it's sort of a cliche, but I wish I could have spoken to my younger self.
Yeah.
When I was dealing with that, because it was like it was an issue. Like I did sort of take it home with me, like a confidence issue. But it's one of those confidence issues that it's like, it's not really defined as a thing.
Yeah.
Because that's such an individual experience of, like, it's not just not wanting to stand up in front of people. It's that kind of getting a little bit of stick from other kids when you do it and things like that. And it makes you sort of dread wanting to go.
Yeah, yeah.
So I just wish I could have said to myself, it's fine, mate.
Yeah.
honestly, trust me, it's fine. Couple of years, it all sort of, but when you're in it, you're like, it's all such a big deal, isn't it?
Yeah, when you're immersed in that sort of world. But it's the crazy thing is, like you say, being able to talk to yourself as a kid, you'd be able to say, look, it's everybody, it's not just you. Everybody you are around, even the most confident kid in the school has some of the biggest insecurities, and that's why they're the most confident, because they've got that set of armor on, you know, they're portraying somebody they're not, you know, even the bullies because they've probably got a terrible home life and something's happening at home where they then project that negativity on. And it's I always say with things like that, and I do quite a bit of work with kids, is breaking the cycle, you know. If you've got that negativity and then you project it onto somebody else, it's not going to make you feel any better. All you're doing is increasing that pathway of negative. If you stop it, and it takes a lot, and that's why I've always been keen to try and get, like, not just my system, any sort of mental health coaching or teaching into schools at school age. You know, we have all these conversations at the minute about, you know, gender education and sex education within schools. One of the things that would help with those issues as well is mental health education, you know. It's still that bit of a taboo where mental health is a negative, you know. It's like we're acknowledging there's an illness within the young communities, but it's not. It's just giving them the tools to deal with the challenges that will come up. But it's a hard conversation to get in.
It is, there's so many things that you do pick up as you get older and that would have been useful to have known.
Yeah.
It's like little things like breathing techniques.
Yeah, massive on breathing. I love it.
Like I sort of, in the lockdown, was it lockdown? I think it was it coming out of lockdown, where I had so much going on.
Yeah.
There's too much for me to think about.
Yeah.
And then I'd sort of, it all become a bit too much. And then I started meditating. Or going online and finding the meditating things. But what I discovered was, I didn't need to meditate, I just need to breathe. And that is enough for me to get out of it what I want. So now, like, sometimes I'm just driving, I'll just... And it's so simple for me. I know it's probably more complicated ways of doing it, but it's literally breathe in and then breathe out for longer than you breathe in. That's sort of all I do. And it calms me right down. I do it before I go to sleep. And I haven't had any problems like that.
Yeah,
but it just get, I don't know what the word is, but it just gets you in that zone.
Yeah, it's, do you know, it's something that we kind of picked up in the military that we didn't even know we were being taught at the time. You know, when you're on the range and you're firing weapons, it's all about controlling your breathing, and it puts you in that state of peak performance, you know, to get the round down the thing. And it's something I picked up later in life again when I kind of came back into the journey, exploring mental health and different techniques and stuff. And, you know, I went the full journey. I got the Sanskrit tattoo that which says take a breath. And it's kind of there to remind me that when things are tough or things are challenging, it's take a breath. Because I think the coaching world, when you're helping people all the time, it's actually a very sort of weighted environment. You kind of take other people's problems on, and you kind of forget sometimes as a coach to take a breath yourself and take that clarity. Yeah, but yeah, taking a breath is key.
I don't really get nervous for gigs anymore, but occasionally there'll be a gig that will just spike my nervousness a little bit before. Yeah. Like I did, so I sold out the Brighton Comedia on Monday, and like that venue's quite a big deal to me because it was like a quite an important venue in the early days,
yeah,
and then just to sell that out on a Monday,
yeah,
and know all those people out there were there specifically to see me. I was like, I wasn't sort of nervous as in worried about the show. I was just like, it just adds the pressure, like, I have to deliver,
yeah,
because all those people have come.
Yeah.
So I just did a few breaths then.
Yeah.
Got me in the zone and I was good as gold. But it's knowing to do that. Whereas if you don't know to do that, you could just let that get too much for you and then your performance might be affected.
And like you say, the simple thing of taking a breath can change your whole mindset. You know, it's a crazy thing that if we introduced it in schools, it can aid in so many ways, you know, with a negative event or exam stress is probably the biggest one, you know. Introducing techniques on how to stay calm, how to stay focused,
would benefit kids massively.
So much. Yeah. So do you find you get more, not stress as you say, for live gigs or, you know, like doing TV, like Mock the Week and things like that?
Yeah, I don't really.
Because obviously it's recorded, well, but is it?
Oh, I mean, the first Mock the Week, I was so nervous. But what I found was, as soon as I got on there and delivered the first line and got a laugh, that all went.
Yeah.
It's fine. I was back to, oh, this is what I do. It's essentially, it's doing stand-up, but sitting down.
Yeah.
So I'm well-trained for this. And so, so as soon as I got the laugh, it was fine. And the second time I did Mock the Week, again, I was quite comfortable. I wasn't particularly nervous. But I kind of worked out quite fairly early on that I personally don't perform well with any nervous energy.
Yeah.
So a lot of comedians like nervous energy. It sort of helps them.
Yeah.
But I'm the opposite. It doesn't help me at all. And also going back to, I linked it recently back to when I used to compete in taekwondo to a fairly good level. And I was always very nervous before the fights.
Yeah.
And I would never fight well when nervous.
Yeah.
Whereas when I'm in the club, in a comfortable environment, it comes back to that being comfortable.
Yeah.
In a comfortable environment, you couldn't touch me. I was so much better in that when I'm not nervous. So I also now wish I knew what I know now. I could go back to when I was competing. Because I think I would be even better because I'd know how to control that.
Yeah.
Because I got, so with performing, I developed my own little technique, which I don't think is common, where the way to calm me down and get me in that zone where I'm completely relaxed before going on, I used to just stand backstage and just say, I don't give a shit, 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 don't give a shit. And I'd just repeatedly say it, and it'd just get me so relaxed, like, and I wouldn't give a shit.
Yeah.
So I'd walk out, and I'd be so relaxed, and my performances would always be so much better than, you know, I want to please you, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So that made a big difference, and now it's just, like, default, so I don't even think, unless I've got a particularly big gig or something.
Yeah.
Like I'm just so relaxed going in now that sort of I've trained myself to.
Yeah, you've programmed yourself.
Yeah. Yeah, essentially. And I'm just so much, I think I'm quicker when I'm relaxed as well. I think that makes such a difference with, you know, how fast my brain works.
Yeah.
Because I think if you're nervous, there's so many more things you're thinking about.
Yeah, you're not focused.
Because like someone says something, a suggestion, you go, if you're nervous, you go, I've got to think of something funny now, I've got to think of something funny now. Whereas when you're relaxed, it's like, it just comes to you.
Yeah.
And if it doesn't, you can roll with it. Like it's,
And I suppose, like you say, with the taekwondo, it's the same thing. You know, I've got a few fighters that I speak to on a regular basis, and they talk about the more relaxed they are, the more, it's kind of like a flow state, there's less muscle tension. You know,
I really wish.
Move quicker, and
really wish I knew this back then.
And I suppose it's one of those things we're all learning now as we start to creep up the years, but I suppose it's imparting it on your younger self. Would your younger self have listened?
If you told my younger self about breathing, I go, yeah,
nice one.
And then I wouldn't do it.
yeah. stop breathing just to make a point.
Yeah.
It was one thing. My dad, he used to drum into us all the time, because we were swimmers as kids, and it was the old they can because they think they can, and that was probably an insight to mental coaching before I even knew I was getting mental coaching. Yes. It was like, if you believe you can do it, you can do it. And then like 40 years on, I'm kind of like, all right, I get that now. That makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
But at the time, I suppose I didn't really understand it. You know, it was kind of just like, it was something we got repeated, you know, before an event, or, you know, I can believe I can do this sort of thing. But I now understand how much benefit that's probably had across the path of my life that I now get. You know, it's like every time I went on a selection course or whatever it was in the military, it was like, you know, there was one point it was like, oh, you shouldn't be here. You know, this is for Royal Marines and Parachute Regiment. You know, guys like you don't pass this course.
Right.
It was like, okay, well, you know, I believe I can, so I'm going to do it. You know, and I suppose like yourself, I've always been one where if somebody tells me I'm not going to be able to do it or I can't do it, it's kind of the old F you. I am going to do it, you know.
Yeah, my dad had a similar thing, because he was coaching my taekwondo back when I was younger. And he had a very much, no matter who it was a no question, you can beat this person. There was never any kind of negative thought going into it for him. I still genuinely believe he believed every time.
Yeah.
I don't know whether he did or not, whether that was just a thing to try and get us thinking positively.
Yeah.
But I truly believe that he thought we could beat anyone. Yeah.
Yeah.
Whereas in my head, I didn't think that. So that, you know, at the time, I don't think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. My dad tells a story when he was a heavyweight boxer when he was younger, and he went to this sort of spit and sawdust gym in Glasgow to fight this guy, and he always tells the story, you know, if he'd known going into it that this guy was like a local hard man, you know, the couple of hundred people there to watch it were, you know, in awe of him and fear of him at the same time, he said he'd have got beat that night. He said, but he went in there with no preconceptions, anything like that, no programming or who this guy was. He was just another opponent. And he laced them all over the place. But he said after when the guy hit the canvas, the place erupted, and he thought they were going to kill him, because he just, you know, he toppled the local hero sort of thing. But he said if he'd have known that prior, it could have been a totally different result. And
so did it erupt in a positive way towards
him? No.
Oh, it didn't?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought it might be like, oh, someone actually beat the good guy. Because no,
I think it might have been they were worried now that this guy's going to be seriously unhappy and just go around beating everybody up for the next couple
of months. Right. So I used to play basketball, and we used to, it's from my sort of little town, and it was just some basically really sort of skinny white guys, and we go and play in these, like, we're in the National League under 16s or something.
Yeah.
So we go to some quite intimidating places. I remember when we played Brixton, you walked in and they had loads of support on the side, all kind of tough, hard-looking people. And we were just these little intimidated. But then whenever we did anything, because we were quite good, like everyone on all their support started taking a piss out of their own players, because it was like, it's like, it's embarrassing for them, but it's ridiculous that we'd sort of pull something off.
So it's like, you know, when you're up on stage and you do get the heckles, I've noticed that your audience interaction is probably up there, second to none with any comedian I've seen. It's the way you kind of take it, and I think it's the one-liner thing, it's the quick-witted, the quick-thinking. You actually turn it into almost, it feels like it's part of the show. Is that is that something you prep for, or again, is that just something that is just a natural? Because I suppose you don't know what people are going to say, but I seen a thing you'd done a while back where it was, you know, like your stock responses for heckles and things. And, you know, do you have a big range of stock, or is it a lot of it just straight off.
No, I don't have. I don't actually have any stock
so you don't
heckle
bother with
replies.
That, no. Yeah.
No, no, because that's an old thing. There's a few like the classics, like. Again, I don't know how rude you want me to go, but yeah, it's funny. Like if someone interrupts you, you sort of say, you're interrupting me. It's not like I come down to your work and knock the cocks out your mouth. Yeah. Like it's, that's like all the classics. Yeah. But no, I don't, I used, they used to, when I was new, there's always anxiety about hecklers and things. And
yeah.
You think, oh, I need some stock, you know, I need some things to say. But
yeah.
Like it's again, it comes down to a relaxed thing. I'm so relaxed now. I just
roll
go with whatever it is. Like the one-liners off of topics,
yes,
that's a slightly different thing. Like I've got some jokes. Over the years, I've written so many jokes. So I've got a lot of jokes on different things, but also a lot of them. If it's something like that's never come up before, a lot of them are off the top of my head. But then once I've done that, that's then in the bank. If you know what I mean.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But with hecklers, I think I'm different to a lot of people, because a lot of people, I think, because there is that intimidation thing about hecklers, and you're, as a new act, you're worried about it.
Yeah.
People go in quite hard.
Yeah.
Whereas I don't at all. I'm almost the opposite.
I think that's when you watch. It's almost like it's like a flow rather than like you say, like an abrupt put down, move on.
Yeah,
down.
Yeah.
You kind of, it's almost like you bring them in and use them as part of the show, and then move on back to where you were, and it's an artwork.
it's quite hard to be horrible to someone when they're being nice to you.
So
that's why I try to make friends with them almost. I've never actually thought about I must do this, I must do that. That's just me.
Yeah.
So I think when I became myself on stage, that's when that stuff started to work. Because if I was in the street, I wouldn't call someone a C word.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like I'd, you'd sort of go, what's going on?
Yeah.
Where's this coming from? Yeah. Do you know what I mean? So and that, I guess that's what I do. Yeah. I just try and be myself up there.
Yeah.
And that, you know, and I think that, like I say, because not many people do that. So.
Yeah, no, it's definitely, it makes, I think, for better watching, I think, because it's more smooth, there's no kind of abrupt stop.
I do get comments about that, about, after the Brighton show, someone said they like my audience interaction because I'm not just trying, I don't just abuse the front row.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, and, which is
and also,
an
hopefully
old
that,
cliche thing again, isn't it, in comedy?
What's interesting, actually, is I don't know if this is a coincidence or not, but some of these shows on tour, like I'm doing Leicester Square Theatre, and you can, if you go onto the website, you can see where the tickets have been sold.
Yeah.
And I've done it, I did it once last year, I've got another one coming up this year, and then we've got another date in next year. And the front always fills up first.
Yeah.
Whereas if you look at some other people's, they're more of the back fills up first.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'd like to think that that's because they feel comfortable enough that, you know, they might get involved, but they're not going to be made to feel.
Yeah, it's a positive
stupid.
Involvement. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, because it's always something I've looked at with the clips I've seen and things, and it's almost like it's the perfect example of a negative, and then you turn it into a positive. It's like somebody's interrupted, which other comedians would maybe take as a negative and be quite abrupt, but you kind of go, all right, how do I use this? And then you carry the show with it through. And then I've seen a few times you then go back to it and kind of bring them back into it again because somebody else is. And it's I always say it's an artwork. It's comedies is something that I think is quite underestimated by, you know, your ordinary people in the street who can't do it. You know, it's there's a lot of intelligence behind it, I think, is missed.
I think that also is helps. I think one-liners helps that for me, because if you're a storytelling comic and you're deep into a story and someone interrupts,
it breaks the chain.
It can ruin the whole thing. And sometimes you might try to keep going through it, and then people have been distracted. Whereas with one-liners, I'm in the mindset where if they ruin one-liner, it's fine. I've got loads more.
Yeah.
Like I don't let it bother me. But I think if you're well into a story and someone does, naturally you'll be quite angry about that.
Yeah.
And again, that could probably naturally come through.
And I suppose, like you say, you prep for the show with, I don't give a shit.
Yeah,
and you're in flow state, whereas other comedians might be running on, you know, that nervous energy where that sort of moment could just be the sort of tipping point where you go, ah.
Yes, and I never do a completely the same set every time.
Yeah.
I've got a lot of jokes and I like to just do whatever feels right, you know, at different times.
Sort of feel the room. Yeah.
So if there's a bit that gets ruined, it doesn't really bother me too much.
Yeah. And sort of talking about other comedians, who would you say has been somebody you've looked up to or has been an influence or somebody you regard as sort of top of the game? Because I know you've opened for people, you know, like Sean Locke and people like that, you know, before, where he's considered the comedian's comedian.
It's funny, not specifically for my style, like I don't kind of relate to it in that way, but I always loved Sean Locke when I was as a punter, essentially, not as a comedian, almost, like I just thought he was so great. And I only met him that once, and that was just by chance, really, because I'd done quite a lot of support for other sort of big names. But I was sort of known as a safe pair of hands, I think. And I was doing a gig in Chester, and Sean Locke's agent phoned me and said, I see you're in Chester. Sean Locke's stuck on a train. Can you run across to his show, the other side of the road, basically, and open his show for him? So I did that. And then when I got off, I had to run to go and do my other gig. But we did cross paths just for sort of 2 minutes, and I spoke to him, and he was very nice. I mean, obviously, I saved his bacon. But I was really chuffed that I met him.
Yeah.
Especially in that environment as well. Just to say you've opened for Sean Locke, I thought was really cool.
But he's
not someone I would say was an influence on me particularly. I think he's brilliant, but like I'd say someone like Lee Mack.
Yeah.
Who is just, I mean, he is the quickest.
Yeah.
So that's kind of like, again, a little goal, a little challenge. I want to be as quick as that.
Yeah.
And then obviously Jimmy Carr as well, like for the early days, I think that's sort of got me on the road I'm on, comedy wise. But the thing is, there's a comedian, so influence on my act is those sort of people. But as far as enjoyment of watching comedy, as a comedian, because I watch so much comedy all the time, every day I see comedy, you kind of get a little bit numb to your standard comedy.
Yeah, got you.
So the things that make me laugh are weird comedians.
Yeah.
Or slightly left field. A bit like Sean Locke. So that's why I enjoy Sean as a punter.
Yes.
Because I think with comedy, it's all about surprise, right? That's what makes you laugh, is surprise. And I'm only surprised by comedians I don't really understand.
Yes.
So I don't understand how they get to do what they do, really. So that's why I really like it. Like there's a comedian, David Earl does a character called Brian Gittins. So you'll know him. Yeah. You know him from a lot of Ricky Gervais stuff.
Yeah.
Like I love going to watch his hour long shows because it's so weird, and half the audience get it, half the audience don't get it, and I get enjoyment out of that.
Yeah.
And I don't know what he's going to do next, which is sort of, you know, because I can't do that.
I get
more out of it. And then you've got people like Spencer Jones, who's like a prop comic, but he's mad.
Yeah.
Like anything that's a bit out there. I really like Flight of the Conchords as well. Like, I just think they're the best musical comedians. I listen to their stuff a lot because it does have proper jokes and surprises, but they're such talented musicians. They sort of merge it so well together.
Yeah, I remember seeing, and I wish I could remember the guy's name, but he played guitar, and it was in a comedy club in London above a pub. You know, it's proper part of the old circuit, and he was just insanely good. He'd done Rude Disney songs and things like that. But it was,
how long ago was that?
Oh God, I must be going back a good 10 years. 10, 12 years, yeah. Because what we used to do was we used to get tickets for troops. So we'd get free tickets for events. So we'd always go to the Army-Navy game every year in London. And the night before, we'd try and get tickets for a comedy club or whatever it was, you know, just to make a full weekend of it. And the guy was just insanely... I wish I could remember his name, but...
This happens a lot. People never, ever remember comedians' names because... Whenever anyone tells me a story about a comic, I always want to know who it is because I know them.
Yeah,
and people never remember it, and it's an interest. It's interesting.
It was probably down to being in a military group and probably having far too much to drink that I can't remember.
But there's jokes
he told on the night that just kind of they're always there, and it was the whole Disney thing, you know, changing it to quite explicit lyrics about your mother and things like that. But to the sound of a Disney theme song on a guitar, and it was like you say, it's that surprise. It's you weren't expecting it. It came from left field.
Yes, exactly. Yeah,
made it really enjoyable. Yeah. So obviously you've won a lot of awards so far. What is your final goal? You know, or where's your aim? Because obviously you're doing Mock the Week. Obviously you. I don't know if you were personally responsible. I didn't think you were that bad to get it cancelled, but...
It's funny you say that. I actually, that's my go-to answer in interviews when Mock the Week comes up, because I say I actually have checked, and officially I was not to blame.
You weren't to blame.
But to be honest, it's... My sort of... Because I sort of, as you sort of know now, I fell into this. I never really had the goal of being a celebrity or being on telly all the time. Like, I didn't even know I'd be able to do this as a full-time job.
So
my dream has always been the actual job of it, the doing the stand-up. And touring was always my dream, to tour to people that want to come to see my show. And I'm doing that now, so that's like a dream come true, really. Yeah. But I want to do that to... So I supported Rob Brydon on tour. And we were playing to 2,000 seater venues, and there's something about playing to that many people is amazing. So that's what I want. That's like, just those gigs were so fun, and it's hard to explain playing and making 2,000 people laugh. I don't even have aspirations particularly to play like arenas. Like, I don't think you'd get as much out of it.
Yeah, it's funny,
I mean, obviously,
you say that, because I've seen a few interviews with comedians, and they kind of say that bit, the in-between venue size, has always been their favourite. Obviously, they enjoy the process of coming up in the clubs. When they've done the bigger venues, like the stadiums and things, it's like you say, it's too many people, if that's possible.
Yeah, they're not designed
about the money, but you know, it's
well, that is what it comes down to. Because if 16,000 people in London wanted to watch me,
you wouldn't say no.
And pay for tickets, I probably would do the O2.
Yeah,
but and also it's, to say you've done it is quite a big thing.
Yeah,
but for enjoyment, both sides,
for
comedians'
the art,
enjoyment,
okay. Yeah.
And for the audience enjoyment, I think that 2,000 seater venue is intimate
size.
Enough.
Yeah.
And that many people laughing, especially for doing one-liners, is phenomenal, because you get everyone who gets the joke quick laughs, and then everyone catches up, and you have this beautiful spread of laughter.
Yeah.
And there's nothing like that feeling. Yeah. Whereas in like a small venue, say 30 people, if half get it quick and then the other spread, you don't get that same feeling. It's very much ha ha ha, okay, next one.
Yeah.
Whereas in those big rooms, it's just this great, because then people start laughing at the people that were too slow. Do you know what I mean?
There's their own little jokes are going on.
Mm. So for me, that's what my goal is, to be able to do a big tour like that, and international as well. I'd love to travel and do. Yeah. I'm doing the Australian comedy festivals next year for the first time, and I'd love to eventually get to a point where I could go there and people are coming specifically to see me.
Yeah.
And America, definitely America. I'd love, I mean, that's
yeah.
that's one of those dreams. It's like, it's achievable.
Yes.
It could happen.
Yeah.
but don't sort of put all your eggs in that basket. Do you know what I mean? It's like,
I think that's where some people do go wrong in various industries like music and things as well, is that trying to do the American dream, as they call it, and it just puts too much pressure on and takes, they kind of, I wouldn't say, I'd say sell out, you know, what has actually got them to where they are to get to that next point, and it lasts such a small period of time and they drift away.
And I think with that, you need to do so many things over there. It's like you need to be Hollywood, essentially. But the beautiful thing with social media is that's another avenue of how to get there, because it's all about just getting in front of as many people as you can. And like, I'd love to do more TV, I'd love to do sitcoms, I'd love to do all that sort of thing. But if that doesn't happen, but I can still achieve those goals through social media, I'm happy as Larry. Like, I don't need to do those other things. I just want to be able to do whatever I need to be able to do the job.
Oh, happy days. Well, I normally finish up with two questions, but I'm going to go for three with you. The first question is a quote or a piece of music that you kind of go to if you need a positivity injection.
Oh, if I need to get up for something, I'll listen to some sort of rock, something fairly heavy. There's a band called Ghost that I really like, and they've got a few tracks that kind of get you really sort of buzzing and up for something. Dance Macabre is like a really good song. I don't know if you probably, it's a bit niche.
No,
And then Karate Kid's my favorite film ever. That's like, I'm a bit of a geek when it comes to that. And like the last song in the main film, You're the Best, that's quite a good song to.
I've actually got that on my running
There you
playlist. That's
go.
one
So
of the,
that's one that sort of gives me the feels and sort of gets me up for it. Is that the question? I think, is that the question? Right,
It is.
cool.
It's one of them. Some people have, like, you know, seize the day and, you know, different
Okay,
quotes
no, I've never
or,
had that. I've never
yeah.
been a lyric.
Fighters are always the easiest ones. Anytime I've interviewed a fighter, it's obviously their walkout music is what gets them in that state ready for a big
Well, and as
leap.
an album, when we were sort of 16, 17, 18, doing the Taekwondo training, there was a group of me and my brother and two of my friends. We were like the little team of, we just trained three, four times a week, really heavy, spit and sawdust gym. And we'd always play the Bon Jovi Crossroads album, which to us is like that switches us in the zone as soon as we hear Living on a Prayer. And then it used to really, really annoy me when I go to nightclubs and Living on a Prayer was considered cheese. Like, that really used to frustrate me so much, because to me, that's a fighting song to get really. And then everyone's, it really irritates me. But yeah, that's an album that if I switch that on, that gets me focused
That's
and,
such
you
a
know.
such a perfect example of linguistic programming, because it's for you,
Yes.
it's programmed as a fight song. For other people,
Yeah.
it's a cheesy pop song.
That means the session's about to start. We mean business. I got kicked out of so many
I was going to say, it's probably a bad one for
nightclubs
nightclubs for you. And then, have you got a practice that you do, and I think I already know the answer, to take you from the negative to the positive?
Yeah, I guess that. I've never got any others. Well, I mean, so yeah, for as an actual technique, that the what I said earlier, but I think, but like practice and like working hard is a technique, I think, to go from a negative to a positive, because that's the only way you can really achieve something is to, it's like if it's basketball, I ended up getting the key from my PE teacher, and I'd get to school an hour before school, I'd open up the sports hall and I'd just be shooting, 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 because that was, I think someone told me I'd never get into the Kent team, because that was quite a big thing at the time, getting to your county team. And then I did get there because I dedicated that time. And it's exactly the same with comedy. I do this, it's the same thing. It's you write, and then you get the gold comes. But you can only get it if you do
If
the
you put
work.
hard work.
So that's, I guess that's sort of a technique.
Yeah, no, definitely. It's like, you know, anything, you've got to have 100% application and belief in what you're doing, or it's, I always think, why are you doing it? It's, you know, if you're gonna do it half arsed, you're gonna get half arsed outcome. You know, if you, like you just said, if you do the gold standard, you're gonna get the gold. So yeah, no, total makes sense. And one that I don't ask everybody, you know, what's your favourite joke? I suppose nobody ever asks you this. This will be a total shock.
I mean, there isn't really one.
Yeah.
But there is one I always give the answer.
Yeah.
And it's a Bob Monkhouse joke, because I just think Bob Monkhouse is someone who I think I really wish I could have met him. Like, I know a few comedians that actually did know him.
Yeah.
And I like listening to stories, because he did all the presenting TV shows.
He was almost forgotten. He was a comedian, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and he was one of the first of that era where he would write his own stuff.
Yeah.
Which, and he's got loads of brilliant jokes, but there's one that's so simple, but it's just perfect. Both sides of the joke is, when I told people I wanted to be a comedian, they laughed. They're not laughing now.
Yeah.
Which I think is brilliant. Yeah. And I actually, I watched the Joker film. Have you seen the Joker film?
Yeah.
It's a brilliant film. I really loved it. But one thing I really hate in it is that when the character of the Joker tries stand up, and they wanted to show him have a bad gig, he did that joke.
Yes.
And what annoyed me was they showed it as a joke that didn't work.
Yeah.
Like not a good joke.
Yeah.
And that really wound me up. One, did they have permission to use that from Bob Monkhouse's people?
Yeah.
And two, why was it? It doesn't make sense. It's a brilliantly crafted joke.
Yeah.
That's not a good example,
like,
of a bad joke.
Two punchlines. It's
yeah. Yeah, it just works. It's great.
Yeah.
So yeah, that really, you know, that annoyed me. But I think that's a cracking joke. But I mean, there's a million jokes I love. But yeah, that's the one I'm going for.
Ah, happy days. Is there anywhere people can come and see you?
Well, I'm doing a tour, so some of the tour. I mean, a lot of this leg of the tour sold out, but we're putting some more in. Sort of May, June time. So just go to marksimmons.co.uk or my social media at jokeswithmark.
Well, that was Mark Simmons. I have to say, one of my favourite comedians. And if you've seen any of his stuff, I'm sure you'll know why. And if you haven't, follow the links I'll post at the bottom. You will not be disappointed. I love Mark's mentality, something I'm sure not only young performers can learn from, but anyone going into an environment with a pressure element. Once you can find that calm flow state, you're one big step closer to peak performance. I thought about leaving you with a joke this episode, but I thought better of it, and I'll leave that to the professionals like Mark. So, from me as always, choose positivity, and I'll see you next time on the Positivity Podcast.